Yes. So I will start. I'm Ken Irvine from Rutgers University, and I'll start by thanking Boris and Eileen and Mike, who I haven't seen, but I'll thank him anyway, for inviting me to be part of this workshop. And I decided today that I wanted to talk to you mostly about some work that we've done to try to understand how the growth of the Drosophila wing is regulated by the fat signaling pathway, but I'm going to start off with a little bit of background and introduction into wing growth in Drosophila as a model for studying growth. And I learned from the talks yesterday that I should put my two most important slides first, so let me start with the thanking members of my lab. This is the current lab group, and I'll talk today, at least in part, about some work from Cordelia Rauskob and probably some work from Yaopeng Mao and Gowei Pan, and maybe Venu Reddy. And I'll also be mentioning some work from Dragana Ragulia, Yong Chung Feng, and Hiroyuki Ishikawa, if there's time, which are some former members of the lab. And as a summary, the main point or idea that I want to get across to you today is the idea that wing growth is controlled, in part at least, by proteins that are expressed in gradients. And this is an example of one of these gradient expression patterns where it's high at the outside of this tissue and graded lower as you go in towards the center. And these gradients work in part by polarizing cells. We think that both the direction in which cells are polarized and the degree to which they're polarized could be important, with the direction influencing planar cell polarity and the degree influencing growth. All right, so the Drosophila wing, which is shown here, comes from the wing imaginal disc. And you heard about the wing imaginal disc yesterday in Francois's talk. And he was talking to you about basically this part of the disc. So he ignored this part, and I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to talk to you about this part of the disc and ignore this part, because this is the part of the disc that gives rise to the adult wing. So this wing develops from what we refer to as a wing imaginal disc. And this is a cluster of undifferentiated epithelial cells, which are set aside at the embryonic stage as clusters of 40 or 50 cells in their different imaginal discs for different parts of the body. And then they grow mostly during the larval stages. And I borrowed this figure from the paper from Frank Ulliker and Marcos Gonzalez-Gates, on which I understand you discussed last week, is it just emphasizes very nicely the progression of wing growth during development. So these are wing imaginal discs at different time points. These would be hours after egg laying. So this 48-hour time point would be a wing disc, basically at the beginning of this second larval instar stage, and 130 hours, this would be at the very end of larval development as it's just about to start pupation. During the course of larval development, there's about a 1,000-fold increase in the number of cells in this disc. And the growth of the disc is mostly a consequence of cell proliferation. So there are not great changes in the sizes of cells. There's not a lot of cell death normally. So we basically can approximate growth as cell proliferation.
What's the marker?
This marker here is actually DPP expression. All right, so you have this amazing amount of growth, 1,000-fold increase. And what controls this growth? And we can divide this at one level into two basic kinds of factors. So there are extrinsic factors that control growth, and one of the most obvious would be nutrition. And that's illustrated by this picture here. We have two adult Drosophila females, and this is the fly that's been raised under normal healthy conditions, and this is a fly that's been starved. So if the flies don't have enough nutrients, then they won't grow as much, the disc won't grow as much. They actually pattern pretty nicely. You just get a miniature fly. But there are also disc intrinsic factors. A lot of growth control is governed not by extracellular signals, hormonal signals that the disc sees, but there's a lot of control of growth that's just within the disc itself. And I think that's illustrated very nicely by some classic experiments people did, where they took a disc and dissected it out of an earlier stage larva, like a second instar larva, early third instar larva. And you can take that disc and transplant it into the abdomen of the female fly, and that basically works as a culture system. And the disc will grow there. And they grow and they reach approximately their correct size. So that tells you that the extent of growth that you're getting during these larval stages isn't governed by things that are happening during the course of larval development, for example, different hormones. There's a growth control that's intrinsic to the disc. All right, and one of those intrinsic factors is the positional information within the disc, and that also really is an idea that comes out of classic regeneration experiments done 20, 30 years ago. So, for example, you can take an imaginal disc and cut out a piece of that disc, and you can transplant it into the female abdomen, and it will regenerate the missing parts. And because the amount of growth that happens to regenerate the missing parts depends on what you cut out, it tells you that the disc knows, or the cells know, basically, how much tissue they're missing. They know how much they need to grow to fill it back in. So there's some kind of disc intrinsic controls of growth that seem to relate to the positional information within the disc. Well, we know a lot about the patterning of this tissue, and one of the most important regulators of both patterning and growth in the imaginal discs is a secreted signaling molecule called decapeneplegic, and this is a member of the BMP family of signaling molecules. And in the wing imaginal disc, as is schematized here by this yellow stripe, it's expressed in a stripe of cells along the center of this disc. It's along what we refer to as the anterior-posterior compartment boundary. And that's going to end up being the stripe of cells along the center of the wing right here. And studies from a number of labs a number of years ago showed that this DPP molecule really works like a classic morphogen. So it's secreted by the cells in the center of the disc, secreted, spreads extracellularly. People still argue about how it spreads, but it's clear that it does spread, and it interacts with its receptors on neighboring cells in Drosophila. The two receptors are called punt and thick veins. These are transmembrane proteins that have kinase activity. They're activated by interaction with the ligand. One of the consequences is they phosphorylate this transcription factor called MAD. And that phosphorylated MAD gets together with other transcription factors, goes into the nucleus, and regulates gene expression. Now, because the signaling results in phosphorylation of this MAD protein, you can use the antibodies that specifically recognize the phosphorylated form of MAD as a readout for the activity of this signaling pathway, and that's what's shown down here in purple. So you can see there's highest levels of phosphorylated MAD in the center of the tissue, and then there's a gradient of decreasing activity as you go out to either side. So this is a way of visualizing the activity of the pathway that occurs in response to the localized expression of this signaling molecule. And studies from a number of labs showed, particularly probably Konrad Basler's lab and Steve Cohen's lab, showed that this, and Gary Struhl, showed that this molecule really acts as a morphogen, right? And that's illustrated here by looking at the expression of two genes that are regulated by the activity of this pathway, and they're regulated in different patterns. So the one here, SAL-SHBALT, is expressed in a narrow domain in the center of the disc because it responds to higher levels of activity of this pathway, and then there's another gene here, OMB, which is expressed in a broader domain because it can be turned on at lower levels of activity. Right? So there's a gradient of activity and graded responses to the activity of this pathway across the disc. It's working like a classic morphogen, it seems. Now, interestingly, this DPP signaling pathway also controls or promotes growth in the wing, and that's illustrated in these two figure panels here, which come from a paper from Gary Struhl's lab, indicated down here. And DPP, from experimental manipulations, is both necessary and sufficient to promote the growth of the wing. So if you don't have any DPP, you don't make a wing. The wing doesn't grow. But if you misexpress DPP, so DPP would normally just be expressed in a stripe of cells along here. If you express it somewhere else in this tissue, you can stimulate overgrowth. You get new growth, increased proliferation in this tissue. Yeah? Yes? Well, it does. So it does both. So you can't really dissociate them. But it does repattern the wing, but it also promotes growth. And the way that growth is organized actually depends on exactly where the stripe is. So you could get bigger wings that don't look like they have duplicated wings. But you can look, you can also look, and I'll show an example in a few minutes, directly at cell proliferation, and you can see that you can increase proliferation in parts of the wing by activating this pathway. So it is definitely controlling growth and patterning together. All right, but this leads us to the first question or puzzle that I want to pose for today, and that is that we know that this pathway is active in a gradient across this tissue. There's highest levels of activity in the center of the tissue here and lower levels out here. We know that the activity of this pathway promotes cell proliferation. If you have more activity of this pathway, you can get more proliferation. If you have less activity, you get less proliferation. But if we look at the normal patterns of cell proliferation in this tissue, they're basically evenly distributed, at least through most of larval development. So that raises a question: how do you convert this gradient of activity of this growth factor into evenly distributed cell proliferation across this tissue?
So, the further problem that it seems to grow in the same direction as the axis of EPP, as distinct from a right hand. Doesn't the wing elongate?
So it does elongate. That's a slightly different issue. It doesn't elongate actually along the DPP axis.
No,
we could come to that a little bit later. It's on a proximal distal axis.
Yes.
So we'll come back to that. But if you look at how, I'm not talking about the direction in which things grow. If you look at how much cells are proliferating in this part of the disc compared to this part of the disc, it's basically the same. Okay, and that's illustrated here with a BRDU label. And so there, I would say there's basically three classes of models you can think about to explain this, which we refer to as the threshold model, the inhibitor model, and the gradient model. And these aren't really single models, they're classes of models. So the threshold model would basically say that, well, it's in a gradient, but it doesn't really matter. You just have to have an amount of activity of this pathway above some minimal threshold, and then you grow. And if you're below that level, you don't grow. And this model really doesn't seem to fit very well with the observations that we can get more growth by adding more DPP. And the inhibitor model would say that, well, it's fine, DPP signaling promotes growth and there's a gradient of DPP activity, but you have a parallel gradient of some inhibitor of DPP signaling. And if the two gradients parallel each other, a growth promoting gradient and a growth inhibiting gradient, then you could get evenly distributed growth across the tissue. And there's some evidence in favor of these kinds of models, and we could talk about that in more detail if people want, or maybe come back to it later. But a third class of models would be to say, well, it's not the absolute level of DPP signaling that's important for growth, but the gradient, right? Or some. And what we mean by that is, for example, the relative difference in expression levels between neighboring cells, or the fact that there is a gradient. In other words, that you're using a different aspect of the information in this DPP signaling gradient to control growth. And so what I'm going to try to do today is tell you about some of the experiments that we have done, which have led us to think that this model is at least part of the explanation. But I also want to say this is biology, it's not algebra, so we don't have to choose and say, well, is this the right answer, is this the right answer? Actually, I think that there's more than one mechanism that's involved in providing the answer. But I'm going to focus on some of our experiments that we think support the idea that this gradient model is at least part of the answer. No, I think mechanical feedback is completely on the table. I would put that mechanical feedback, which of course comes from, I think, Boris's classic paper, in the inhibitor model class. So what Boris proposed basically as a solution to this question, if I can paraphrase his work of why you get even growth, is that if you have a local, basically he hypothesized that when cells grow, they exert pressure on their neighbors, and that pressure would inhibit growth in some way. And so that would explain this difference by saying, well, fine, DPP promotes more growth here, but as it promotes more growth, it basically triggers an inhibitor of growth, which is increased pressure, So I would say that the mechanical feedback idea is basically one class of models that I would put within this inhibitor model. If you say that the pressure is coming from growth that's stimulated by DPP signaling, where you get more DPP, you make more pressure, which inhibits growth, and so that equals out. Is that fine with you, Boris? Okay.
So do you see a correlation between cell density and the European leaf staining?
I have to say it's not something that we've tried to correlate very closely. So I really can't answer that. You would expect that, yeah. Well, you know, it really depends on what stage of larval development you look at, because initially the cells are all pretty much cuboidal, and then as you get later on, they start to have different shapes, and some of them become more columnar, and some are more squamous, so the cell density varies, and you get some folds in the tissue. I should say that, you know, the BRDU labeling isn't the only evidence that there's evenly distributed proliferation. Another kind of experiment that people do is to mark a cell at some early stage in development and then make what we refer to as a clone, and then you could look 2 days later and say, well, how big is that clone? That's an indication of how much growth there was wherever you made the clone. And from that kind of analysis, we can also say that growth is pretty much evenly distributed around the disc, at least for most of larval development. All right, so one type of experiment we did a number of years ago to look and try and understand how this DPP gradient was controlling growth is to ask, well, what happens if we change this normal profile of DPP activity? And one experiment we did is to make a patch of cells that act or think that they're receiving a very high amount of this signal. And we did that by making a patch of cells that express an activated form of this DPP receptor thick veins. So schematically, we're going to make a patch of cells that think they have a lot of DPP signal, whereas their neighbors have lower levels of DPP signaling. And one of the things we saw when we did that kind of experiment, which was a surprise to us actually at the time, so we didn't set out to sort of prove the gradient model, we did the experiment and the results led us to favor that kind of idea. So this is one example of a wing disc in which the cells labeled in green here are expressing this activated form of this receptor. And one of the things we saw is that we actually stimulated increased proliferation, not so much in the cells that had the activated receptor, but in the neighboring cells. So there was a non-autonomous effect. And let me just finish this and I'll take a question. And one of the important features of this is that we, with the genetic tricks that we had, we think we could express this activated receptor at the same levels, either in a patchy way like this or in a uniform way throughout the whole disc. So on the right here is a disc in which we express this activated receptor uniformly. And in some parts of the disc, over in these lateral regions, we actually increase proliferation. But in the middle, we actually decrease proliferation. So these cells here and these cells here are seeing the same amount of this activated receptor. But in this case, we're stimulating proliferation here, and here we're not. And so this kind of comparison really led us to argue that there's something important or something special about juxtaposing cells that have received or perceived different levels of activity of this pathway that is sufficient to stimulate cell proliferation. Yes? So if you looked at the the pSMAD, the phosphoMAD, it's high just within the clone. And I kind of glossed over this point, which is important, but I thought it might not be important for this audience. We actually did these experiments with temporal control. Okay. So this effect is actually a transient effect. We see it around the 8 to 24 hours after we turn on the activity of the pathway, and then it actually goes away. And that's, in fact, people had done these kind of experiments before and hadn't seen this effect, and the reason is they hadn't done it with the temporal control.
Is an expression boundary?
No, there's no so the DPP pathway is only activated in here. If you looked at targets of the pathway, they're only activated in here. So this proliferation is it not because of turning on the DPP pathway? Right, yes.
The boundaries, expression boundaries of each targets will do things that are expressed right around the AP border.
Yeah. We really see just in this case, as under the conditions, we look just a cell autonomous response. So cells that are within a clone will have higher level expression of a target of the pathway, just like they'll have increased phospho-MAD. Not sure if I'm really getting your question. Yeah. Okay. So, yes? Well, I don't have it to present here, but we did look at the time course. Not in a very highly quantitative way, but we looked at, you know, 4 hours, 8 hours, 12, 14, 24 out to 48 hours. So what specifically is your question? You're wondering about the time course of the proliferation or pathway activity or? It's a bit complicated. Yeah, so I probably can't do it the way you would like. I mean, in the experiment, the maximal proliferation response was probably around 14 to 16 hours. But it's really not, we're not flipping a light switch and turning the pathway on. The way that we did the temporal control is we had the expression under control of a hormone-regulated form of Gal-4, which we feed to the animals. So there's some time course of them taking up this hormone and increasing transcription. So it kind of increases gradually over a period of about 8 hours. Okay, so it's not a really a tight time course here.
Can we go away
after? Well, if we keep feeding them the hormone, no, then it'll be on, you know, as long as we keep them on the hormone. The response, the proliferation response goes away sometime between 24 and 48 hours.
You keep the
pathway on, this non-autonomous effect eventually goes away. Yeah? Yes? All right, so Boris is referring to this experiment where we activate the pathway uniformly, but we get a lot of proliferation out in the sides, and we actually inhibit it here. Well, so I think there's a couple things going on. One, of course, is you have this endogenous gradient where the activity of the pathway is low here and it's high here. So when we express this activated receptor uniformly, the delta is much bigger at the edges than it is in the middle. So they have a stronger proliferative response. And then there's some work from Conrad Bosser's lab, which has shown that if you actually make cells in one part of a disk proliferate at a very high level, you actually inhibit proliferation in other parts of the disk. And that seems to be independent of the mechanism by which you induce their proliferation. How that works isn't known, but the implication is that having cells proliferate a lot in one part of the disk actually inhibits proliferation in other areas. Yes? Yeah. You're starting from this spatial gradient, and then we're expressing it uniformly everywhere. And these cells, again, remember, we're doing this with a time course. That's what I've maybe glossed over too much. These cells will proliferate much more than these cells. So these cells are seeing a much bigger increase in the levels of pathway activity in time. Yes. Well, it's because we're starting off with a gradient in space that they are seeing a bigger increase in time. Yes? Yeah, that effect is also still transient. Yeah? So we did not, I think we did check for apoptosis and didn't see that. We never checked for JAK-STAT. That really wasn't on our radar at the time that we did these experiments.
Sorry,
yes?
The evidence that DPP is a diffusion gradient?
Well, I was trying to be careful not to say how it spreads. That's a different topic. Okay. Because that, yeah, that's, you could probably spend a whole day arguing about that. All right, so what I really, this is all sort of introduction for me to get to this point, which is to say that, you know, when we did these experiments on DPP, we thought that they supported the idea that cells can respond to differences in levels of DPP pathway activity and that that stimulates proliferation. And if that's the case, then you would think that cells have to have some kind of cell surface molecules that are controlled by this pathway that they could use to compare, okay, how much DPP did you get, how much DPP did I get, and then decide if they should proliferate or not. So the hypothesis really required that there should be some kind of signaling pathway that's regulated by graded signals, and that should involve some kind of cell surface molecules, and that could, should control growth. Right? And so that leads us to the FAT-HIPPO signaling pathway. And I'll now give a brief introduction to this pathway. So HIPPO signaling is a recently described pathway. Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yes, with a time course. Did we knock out the endogenous? No, that was done in the background of the endogenous. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so let me give you a brief introduction to this pathway. So this is a signaling pathway that controls growth. It may not be familiar to many of you because it's a relatively recently described pathway. So I put this very highly simplified schematic of the pathway just to emphasize that this is a signal transduction pathway that basically works like lots of other signal transduction pathways that you're familiar with. There's receptors in the membranes that respond to extracellular signals. There's a signal transduction mechanism that has some kinases. And at the end of the pathway, you end up regulating gene expression in the nucleus. Now, many of the components of these pathway were actually first identified in Drosophila as Drosophila tumor suppressors. So they were identified for their effects on growth. And this shows you two examples of that. One is the FAT gene. This comes from a paper from Peter Bryant's lab. Here's a normal wing imaginal disc, and this is a very extreme example of a FAT mutant wing imaginal disc. So you can see this massive overgrowth. And this is an example of a fly that has a patch of cells or a clone that's mutant for a gene called Wurtz, and that has given you this big growth or tumor on the surface of the fly. Now, these Drosophila tumor suppressor genes, many of them were identified many years ago, and initially it wasn't really recognized how they were connected to each other. But over the last several years, my lab and a number of other labs have been involved in basically putting these genes together into a pathway. And in this pathway, basically transcription ends up equaling growth in many different tissues because there are a number of transcriptional targets of this pathway that play important roles in controlling growth. So these include the MYC oncogene, BANTAM, which is a microRNA gene in Drosophila that's important for growth control, the regulators of cell cycle progression that are targeted by this pathway, E2F1 and cyclin A and B and E, and also inhibitors of apoptosis. So there are a number of transcriptional targets that play important roles in controlling growth. So basically transcription equals growth. And I just put this slide here to give you a basic idea of how the pathway regulates transcription. The key transcription factor in this pathway is a gene in Drosophila that's called YORCI. It's a transcriptional co-activator protein. And it's regulated at the level of its subcellular localization. And the key regulator of YORCI is a kinase, which is in Drosophila is called Wurtz. And this Wurtz kinase negatively regulates the YORCI protein. So when Wurtz is active, most of the Yorkie's in the cytoplasm. So if we look here at a picture, a close-up of part of a wing imaginal disc, these cells that are green here are wild-type cells, red is Yorkie protein, and you see these little holes here. Those are the nuclei, which look like they're holes because they have very low levels of this transcription factor. Most of the transcription factor is in the cytoplasm, which are these rings here. If we take away the Wurtz kinase, make patches of cells that are mutant for Wurtz, these are these unstained areas, now you see this even distribution of this Yorkie protein because some of it's gone into the nucleus. All right, so that's basically how the pathway works. Now, to give you a slightly more complicated version of the pathway, I could really give you a much more complicated version, but a slightly more complicated version, I want to emphasize, so here's Yorkie, our transcription factor, here's Wurtz. There are actually multiple upstream inputs into the regulation of this pathway. So the fat gene, transmembrane protein, is one input into the regulation of Wurtz, but there are also other inputs which seem to work independently from this. And I'm not really going to talk about those, but I just wanted you to keep in mind that Hippo signaling is regulated by a number of different upstream inputs. And I also wanted to point out from the perspective of thinking about a fat signaling pathway, fat is a signaling pathway that has different downstream branches. So just like some of you may be familiar with Wnt signaling, where you have a canonical pathway that regulates gene expression through beta-catenin, but you can also have effects on planar cell polarity from Frizzled and some of the other components of the pathway. Fat signaling regulates both growth by regulating transcription through this Hippo pathway, but it also can regulate planar cell polarity, and we can genetically separate those in some cases. Mm-hmm. Well, so the way we think about it is that you have a lot of these, most of these genes upstream were first found as tumor suppressors, and that's because they all really work as negative regulators of Yorkie. So yes, I'm going to come to this in my talk. There's a few genes in between here, but the ultimate effect is that when fat is active, that allows Wurtz to be active. Okay, and if we take fat away, we get rid of Wurtz. Okay. No, if fat is active, basically means less growth. Okay, the overgrown imaginal disc that I showed you before was a fat mutant. So take fat away, you get inappropriate overgrowth. Okay. Oh, Wurtz is right here. Hip. This is simplified. So Hippo's out. Hippo's over here. We can come to that if we need to. Not the fat branch. Its major regulation of Wurtz actually doesn't go through Hippo. Another question? No. Oh, yes. Oh, sure. You can knock these out. It's been done. They also affect growth. So is that here? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So fat is a transmembrane protein. It's a member of the cadherin family, and we say that because the extracellular domain of the protein has these domains that are called cadherin domains, which are found in these classic cell adhesion proteins called cadherins, but fat has many more of them than the classic cell adhesion cadherins. It's actually a very large protein, more than 5,000 amino acids. And fat, we think of as a receptor for this pathway, which, as I said, has two different downstream branches, one regulating transcription and the other regulating planar cell polarity. So there's one gene that we think of as a ligand for fat, and this is a gene called doxis, and this is also a member of the cadherin family. And this doxis cadherin can actually bind to this fat cadherin. And then there's another gene that's known to be a regulator of this pathway, and that's a gene called four-jointed. And four-jointed is actually a Golgi-localized protein. And what this Golgi-localized protein does is actually a Golgi-localized protein kinase that phosphorylates the extracellular domains of these proteins, their cadherin domains, as they pass through the Golgi, and that influences how these bind to each other. And if there's time at the end of the talk, I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So the point that I want to emphasize here, which is illustrated by examples of their expression patterns, these are actually eye imaginal discs, is that in many different tissues in the fly, we see that these two regulators of fat receptor are expressed in gradients, right? And they're actually always expressed in complementary gradients. So here, for example, doxis is high at the edges of this tissue and low in the middle, and four-jointed is in the complementary pattern, high in the middle and low off towards the edges. And there are several labs that have studied the role of this pathway in planar cell polarity. I don't want to talk about it too much detail, but it's important to for my talk today because it emphasizes how we think about this pathway responding to gradients. So have you had any talks about planar cell polarity in the workshop? Maybe I should, yeah? You have, okay. Okay. So planar cell polarity, just briefly, is a polarization of cells within the plane of the tissue. And it's illustrated in this example here where you're looking at a close-up of the abdomen of the fly, and you can see these little hairs and bristles. And you can see, I hope, that they're all aligned with each other and they're actually all pointing towards the back end of the fly. And in planar cell polarity mutants, this nice alignment of hairs and bristles is disturbed, and fat is a planar cell polarity mutant. So this is the abdomen of a fat mutant fly, and you can see now these swirling patterns of hairs and bristles, so they don't know which way to point anymore. And one of the very interesting features about this pathway, well, let me just back up and say that before people had any molecules or genes that are involved in controlling planar cell polarity, there already was the idea that planar cell polarity might be the readout of some kind of gradient of positional information in a tissue. And that idea was stimulated in part by regeneration experiments. So the fact that you have these molecules, four-jointed and doxis, that are expressed in gradients and can affect planar cell polarity was very intriguing. And in fact, now there's experiments done in a number of labs which have said that the graded expression of these two molecules, four-jointed and doxis, actually can be instructive in terms of planar cell polarity. So I've tried to illustrate this. I've taken a figure panel from a paper from Peter Lawrence's lab, which illustrates very nicely the gradient of expression in this tissue of the doxis gene, so high at one end of this tissue and low at the other, and that's basically matching the direction in which these hairs and bristles are polarized. So along the anterior-posterior axis like this, and people have done experiments where you either take one of these genes away or you overexpress it, and you can see that the cells will repolarize in a manner that's consistent with the idea that the vector, or the direction in which you're going from high to low, instructs the cells about what direction they should polarize. So that tells us that this pathway seems in some way to be able to respond to gradients. All right. All right, so just even to take a step back maybe and think about morphogen gradients. So I think most of the time in developmental biology, when people think about morphogen gradients, they think about a French flag type model, and really what they're thinking about is interpreting the scalar of the gradient. So in other words, you have something that's indicated by this purple line here is in some kind of a gradient where it's high in one region and low in another. And the cells respond to high levels of this gradient by turning on, say, one set of transcription factors, adopting one kind of cell fate, and then in the regions where the gradient's lower, they adopt a different kind of fate. But gradients have other kinds of information. So, yes? So, yeah, so that's one of those complications I'm trying to hide. Fats also in the wing is in a bit of a gradient, okay? A bit like four-jointed, higher in the center and lower out towards the edges, although that gradient doesn't seem to be essential because we have a mutant that can take that away. Yes, so because you're not seeing the doxis there. Yeah, that's another one of those details I was trying to gloss over. So there is, if you did an antibody stain, you would see the protein there. This is actually looking, basically reporting the transcription pattern. And we're not sure if that's because the antibody is more sensitive and we can't actually, then our transcription reporters, or the other possibility is that there's a persistence of the protein from earlier stages in development, because this is a relatively late wing imaginal disc, and if you looked earlier, this central region would be very small, and you would even see the transcriptional pattern there. Okay. Yes?
I thought that was uniformly expressed.
Yes, people have sometimes described it as uniform, but that's not always true. And in the wing, for example, it is actually higher in the most distal part and lower in other regions. So it's not completely uniform, yeah. Higher, well, particularly along the dorsal ventral boundary. But we have a mutant that basically takes that away, and it has a very relatively subtle effects on wing development. Yeah. Okay, so we can interpret this, the scale over gradient. In planar cell polarity, people think, at least in the fat signaling pathway, that you can polarize cells by interpreting a vector over gradient, and there's experimental evidence, at least in some Drosophila tissues, that these gradients of doxis and four-jointed are instructing planar cell polarity. And we think, and I'll tell you about some experiments that have led us to this idea, that in the fat hippo signaling, you're also able to respond to the relative slope of the gradient. Right? So really using three different kinds of information from this gradient. And one of the kinds of experiments that led us to this idea is to think about the way cells respond to this doxis ligand and how they respond to doxis ligand expressed in different patterns. So a doxis mutant has a phenotype similar to a fat mutant. It's actually a weaker phenotype, but it goes in the same direction. They both cause increased growth, right? And what's shown here is the complementary kind of experiment where we've taken a wing disc in the bottom panels here, and we've uniformly, or relatively uniformly, overexpressed this doxis ligand in one half of this tissue, right? So this is the part of the tissue that's going to give rise to the wing here. And if we express this doxis ligand in the cells that are labeled in green, this part of the tissue becomes smaller. There's actually less growth. And the red staining here is actually a transcriptional target of this pathway, DIAP1. It's an inhibitor of apoptosis. And its expression is reduced in these cells where we express the doxis ligand compared to the cells where we haven't manipulated the expression. Right? And this overexpression experiment is consistent with the idea that doxis is a ligand that activates fat, because activation of fat through this whole signal transduction pathway ends up ultimately decreasing activity of Yorkie, which gives us decreased transcription of a Yorkie target and decreased growth. So doxis is a ligand that activates fat. Yeah? It's an inhibitor of apoptosis. That's one of the ways that the pathway helps to regulate growth.
Okay. Yeah?
Yeah, but we're really just, I shouldn't even have said that. We're just really just using it here as a readout of pathway activity, because it's a direct downstream target of the pathway.
And there is less red on the right than the left.
There's less red on the right than over here, yes. There is. No, at these levels, it's not low enough to have a significant effect on apoptosis. If you took the levels down low enough, you would start to get apoptosis.
So I'm just trying to understand. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's because of other targets. Yes, yes. Because there's MYC and Bantam and E2F1, there's a number of different targets that are responsible for the effect on growth. Okay, so you know, if you, in one class of experiments, thinking about a doxis mutant or a uniform expression of doxis, you'd say it's a ligand that activates fat. But then there's this curious feature that if you look along the borders between cells that have different levels of doxis expression, you'd come to exactly the opposite conclusion and say doxis is a ligand that's inactivating fat. And it's easiest to make these borders by making small patches of cells through what we call clones. So these green stained cells here are patches or clones of cells that are expressing this doxis ligand. And what I want to emphasize here is all along the borders of these, we have increased expression of this target of the pathway. And if we look at cell proliferation, we can actually see increased cell proliferation along the borders of these clones. And this is just one example, but we've actually quantified this effect. So in this kind of experiment, you'd say DOXIS is a ligand that's inactivating FAP, because now we're getting more expression of this target of Yorkie, more proliferation. So how can we explain that this ligand has apparently opposite effects on FAP, depending on whether we think about uniform expression or a border of expression? Yes? They don't under these conditions, no. So in fact, we think that the link goes in the opposite direction, that the DPP pathway affects the activity of DOXIS and four-jointed and with working through the FAP pathway. I suppose at this point you could make models like that. That's not our model. We don't have any such model, any such receptor. Yes, I should emphasize that we think we can express this protein at the same levels when we do it uniformly or in a patchy way, because we use transgenes that are inserted in the same place. So I don't think it would be high affinity or low affinity. It's really, do the cells, neighboring cells, have see the same amount of this ligand, or do they see different amounts of this ligand? Yeah?
In the situation where you have this uniform,
mm-hmm. So we did it uniform in half so that you could compare the two halves. But actually, if you look along the edge here, you're seeing this edge effect there as well. I just didn't emphasize it. So the type 1 is low here, but there's this stripe where it's actually higher, which is the border again. So there is a border effect even here. It's just that we only have one border in this kind of experiment as opposed to lots of borders here. It's basically the same.
I mean, unless we're going to get back to the similar question that the difference of DPP. So you just said DPP is like upstream, and before you said that fat might have, if anything, a graded expression higher in the center. And so is DPP responsible for that?
Well, the gradient of fat is actually more along a different axis. It's a dorsal vent, it's a perpendicular axis, so there are other signaling pathways in the wing. Yeah. So DPP fits in by maybe I should go back to the expression patterns for a second. So the expression patterns of these regulators of FAT, DOXIS, and four-jointed are really graded on what we refer to as a proximal distal axis in the wing. So outside to inside, and it's proximal distal because this is a flat sheet of cells here, but during metamorphosis, what's going to happen is that it's basically going to evaginate, come out towards you, and then two halves are going to come together like this. So what was in the center of the disc is going to end up being the distal tip of the wing. And proximal distal really comes about as a consequence of interpreting patterning along two different axes, an anterior-posterior axis and a dorsal-ventral axis. So this pathway really responds to signals along both of these axes. So it's influenced by DPP, but not only DPP. It also responds to patterning along this axis, and that's why it's proximal distal rather than anterior-posterior.
But DPP is just controlling the expression.
Well, I wouldn't say just. No, DPP certainly does other things. And, there is other levels of connection that probably connected at least three or four different points. But I think I'd rather save that for later. Okay. So what I would like to do, yeah, we did that. Okay, so we think that one way to explain this difference, where uniform expression of the ligand it's behaving like it's activating the pathway, but if you look at borders, it looks like it's inhibiting the pathway, is to say, just one sec, that the fat pathway is responding not only to the presence or the level of the doxis ligand, but also to its pattern in expression. And when we've expressed it uniformly, not only have we made more ligand, but we've effectively made a flat gradient. And when we have these borders of expression, we've effectively made a very steep gradient. Right? And so to explain to you how we think that might work, I need to sort of take a little detour for about 5 minutes and tell you a little bit about the signal transduction pathway and a couple components of the pathway, and in particular, components of the pathway that respond to fat activity and these gradients. Yes, question. You're talking about doxis in particular, or just in general?
Yeah, I guess this is probably a question in terms of master and different infection, but do you see any consistent pattern in terms of driving home, whether it's proximal or depends on whether it sort of grows or not?
So in general, in the wing disc, clones tend to grow in a kind of elongated way, and they're elongated along the proximal distal axis, and that's actually regulated by this pathway. And again, that's one of those things we could come to a little bit later, maybe. Okay. So, all right. So, yeah, I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the signal transduction steps that take us from this fat receptor to this Wurtz kinase. Actually, I can do it remotely. So, the major effect we think that fat has on this Wurtz kinase is it actually controls the levels of the Wurtz protein. We think this is a post-transcriptional effect that's probably ubiquitin proteasome-mediated. And it's just illustrated on this Western blot where here's the Wurtz protein isolated from a wild-type wing disc, and here's a wing disc or a couple wing discs that are mutant for fat, and you can see much less Wurtz protein, right? And we can actually rescue a fat mutant just by overexpressing this Wurtz kinase. And that's shown down here. So fat normally is a lethal mutation. We can actually get adult flies out, which are not completely normal, but they're viable, and their growth effect is rescued just by giving them more of this Wurtz kinase. This signaling downstream of fat in this Hippo pathway is completely dependent upon a gene called DOX. And DOX is a myosin family protein. DOX is required for all of the effects that fat has on growth, gene expression. An example of that is shown here, where here's an overgrown fat mutant disc compared to wild-type disc. And if we also take DOX away, then we suppress that overgrowth. And even we can even see that at the level of this Wurtz protein kinase. So this loss of the Wurtz protein is reversed if the tissue is also mutant for DOX. So DOX is this key player downstream of fat in this signal transduction pathway. And another important feature of this DOX protein is that its subcellular localization is regulated by fat activity. So that's illustrated on this slide. And at the top, this is the wild-type DOX localization. And in the wild-type, its localization is actually polarized. And I'm hoping to come back to that in 2 minutes. All I want to do is right now is to say that it's on the membrane on one side of a cell and not another side of a cell. And if we increase fat activity, which we can do just by overexpressing this fat receptor, then we push the DOX protein off the membrane. So the protein's still there, but now it's in the cytoplasm. And if we take the fat gene away, which we can do by using a mutation, now the DOX protein is on the membrane all around the cell, and there's less in the cytoplasm. So fat activity controls the subcellular localization of this DOX protein. And we really think at some level that we can use the localization of this myosin protein as a readout for the activity of fat. And since time is pretty short, I think I'm going to skip this. And just say that there's another component of this pathway that we identified recently. It was actually just published a couple months ago called Zixin. And we think, in essence, that the regulated localization of this DOX protein, that its importance is that it controls the interactions between this DOX myosin protein and this SIXIN protein. Because this is just another example of that myosin protein, if we have a hyperactive fat, we have the protein off the membrane. If we take fat away, it's on the membrane. So fat signaling is controlling localization of this DOX protein to being in the cytoplasm or on the membrane. This SIXIN protein is on the membrane. They can bind to DOX, and they can co-localize when they're at the membrane. So when we're controlling the localization of this DOX protein in the cytoplasm or on the membrane, one of the things we think we're doing is controlling the ability of this DOX protein to interact with this SIXIN protein. And in some binding experiments, which are also in this paper, and I didn't want to take the time to go through them, we found that this DOX protein actually stimulates the ability of this SIXIN protein to interact with this Wurtz protein. So really, we think the regulated localization is a trigger to allow these two components of the pathway to get together, and we think this is a trigger to lead to the destruction or degradation of this Wurtz protein. So the key point to make for now is that we think an important part of the way this pathway works is in controlling the subcellular localization of this DOX protein. Yes? SIXIN is, what sort of protein is it? So it has a number of protein-protein interaction domains. The most prominent one are referred to as LIM domains. So it has three of these LIM domains, which are involved in protein-protein interactions. It's been implicated in both cytoskeletal regulation and in transcriptional regulation. It's probably best known in vertebrates as a protein that's involved in mechanotransduction. So the localization of this protein, for example, to focal adhesions can be influenced by mechanical tension or stress on the cells. So we don't know in Drosophila yet whether this SIXIN protein responds to mechanical tension. Of course, that would be is something that we're interested in. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so we have some sort of preliminary evidence that it is, but we don't really know in detail how it works. We don't know what the ubiquitin ligase is. Yeah, but just from some MG132 treatment experiments, it looks like that's what's going on. Yeah, yes. Well, so in this pathway, we don't have anything that really relies on the motor activity. We think, eliminated the motor activity by making a mutant isoform of DOX, which has a single amino acid change, which in other myosins abolishes ATPase activity. And if a myosin doesn't have ATPase activity, it can't work as a motor. So that protein is inactive, but it's also mislocalized. Basically, it's in the cytoplasm and it's not on the membrane. So we don't really know. You know, you could say, well, it uses its motor to get out to the membrane, but you could also just say, well, it's an inactive protein, and who knows. So we're really not sure exactly what to make of that. Yeah. The conclusion is that at least you need ATPase activity, and that's presumably because of motor activity, although it might be working, say, as an anchor rather than a motor, for example. But, yeah. Well, so we haven't tried to do anything like that, but it has a central domain that looks like a myosin head domain, so it should be able to interact with actin, but we haven't pursued that. Right. And there's some interesting work, not from my lab, but published earlier this year, which suggests that the motor activity of myosin probably is important for the planar cell polarity, or at least part of the planar cell polarity function, that would be something we could come back to later. Okay. That's from Barry Johnson and Nick Tapon. Okay, so now I want to come back to this normal localization of DOX, and I mentioned that it's polarized. So the way that we see that is we make little patches or clones of cells that express a tagged form of this DOX protein. So that's what the green staining is. So the way that you need to look at these is you see this lines of staining here. That's DOX protein on the membrane, on the interface between two cells. And if we look in the middle of a clone or a patch of cells expressing this tagged protein, I can't tell. We don't have enough resolution to say, is that protein on the membrane coming from this cell or from this cell? Okay. But if we look at the edges of these clones, because the tagged protein is only expressed in these cells and it's not expressed in the surrounding cells, now if I see the protein on the membrane, well, I know it's on the membrane on this cell. All right. So the informative part of these clones is the edges of the clones. And what we see is, if we look at one side of a clone, we see the protein on the membrane. And if we look at the other side of the clone, it's not on the membrane. And because that's true of lots of different clones that are made at random in different places in the disk, what we infer is that this DOX protein, its subcellular localization, is polarized in this tissue. It's on the membrane on one side of the cell and not on the other side of the cell. And if you make lots of these clones, you can actually start to make a map and say, well, is there a consistent direction in which the DOX protein is polarized? And there is, and that's indicated by these arrows. And it's basically polarized such that the protein's on the membrane on what we think of as the distal side of the cell, basically pointing towards the center of this tissue. Okay. And, yeah?
How far back can we get this polarity map? I mean,
No, so we are actually going back to this again to try to do a time course during larval development, but I don't have results from that. It's certainly at different stages in third instar you can see that it's polarized, but we don't have a detailed map and we haven't pushed it back to say how early, when does it first arise. There is DOX expression in the embryo. Is there? Actually, no, I have to take that back. So we've expressed tagged DOX in the embryo, and it can polarize. Okay, and as you probably know, there is DOX, and four-jointed have a role in planar cell polarity in the embryo. So we think it's being polarized. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Just let me finish this slide, then I'll take more questions. So the important thing about this map is that basically DOX is polarized in the direction that matches the gradients of expression of these two regulators of the FAP pathway. Because DOXIS and four-jointed are graded along the proximal distal axis. So there's a correlation between the direction in which DOX protein is polarized and the graded expression of these two FAP pathway regulators, which I've illustrated here. And that would suggest that maybe these gradients are actually instructive in terms of polarizing this DOX protein, and we can test that by manipulating these gradients. And one way that we've done that is shown here. Basically, we just made these clones that express this tagged DOX protein, and we co-express with it either the four-jointed protein or the DOXIS protein. So now, going from inside of the clone to outside of the clone, we're basically going from very high DOXIS to very low DOXIS, and that's true completely around the circumference of the clone. And if we do that with DOXIS, now instead of DOX being polarized, it's on the membrane completely surrounding the entire circumference of the clone. And if we do this with four-joint, we get the opposite effect. Now DOX is off the membrane, completely surrounding the circumference of this clone. And basically this is consistent with the idea that these gradients are instructive for polarizing DOX localization, because as we go from high to low DOXIS, we have DOX on the membrane like this. And as we go from high to low four-jointed, we have DOX off the membrane. That's true in the normal case, and that's true in these experimental manipulations. Questions? Yes? No, the green spots are outside are a technical problem with this staining. It's just No, that's just it's just background from one of the antibodies. Yes? So it is certainly a sharper drop off than normal, yes, a much sharper drop off than normal, but still goes in the right direction. Here?
Yes.
Well, here, because I've reversed the gradients here. Maybe that's been confusing.
But the green dots on the cells are in the same place.
Yes. Well, I've I've tried to illustrate the normal case here, because in the normal case, the dark cis grade and four joining gradients are complementary to each other. And dox is always in the same place. But if you think about it in terms of the experiments, low to high four-jointed is going from outside the clone to inside the clone, whereas outside the clone to inside the clone here is, or low to high doxis would be outside to inside. Yeah? Have I confused things? Okay?
So how we, so again, what does four-jointed do to change its path?
Four-jointed influences how doxis and fat bind to each other. Okay? And it's actually more interesting than just positive or negative. And that's something I was going to come to at the end if there's time. But the first level of answer is that it modulates interactions between fat and doxis.
So presumably in those cells, the interaction is weaker or stronger than in those cells and
doxis? Yeah, that's, I could jump ahead to that, or I could continue. What do you want? Yeah. Yes? I don't mind jumping ahead if people want, but yeah. Warts is localized mostly in the cytoplasm, we think. It's actually been a very difficult protein to localize, so the antibodies against it really don't see very much warts. So we have this very faint haze of staining. But I think the interesting question is, you know, is it particularly at the membrane or not? And we don't see it restricted to the membrane. It is also in the cytoplasm. But the best localization is really overexpressed protein, so there's a caveat there. The endogenous protein has been really hard to see. Yeah? Yeah, on the membrane there. Yeah, that's probably the case. Well, doxis is a ligand that can activate fat, and activity of fat pushes dox off the membrane, so it makes sense, actually. Yeah? Okay, so let's do this. So now, as a model, coming back now, I want to, with this overview of dox protein localization, and having told you that localization of dox to the membrane is regulated by fat activity, and that it's normally polarized in tissues, and that it's polarized in response to gradients or differences in expression of doxis and four-jointed, that gives us basically the ideas for the model that I've tried to schematize here. So this is supposed to be a depiction of a cell. And one of the things we're trying to do in this model is to explain this intriguing observation that uniform expression of doxis makes it seem like a ligand that activates a fat, but at boundaries, where cells have different levels of doxis, we see responses, transcriptional responses, that look like fat's been inactivated. So how can we explain that? And what we observe is, so this is supposed to depict a cell in a doxis gradient where we have higher levels of doxis on one side and lower levels on the other. And we observe that this is a condition that leads to polarization of dox. Now, what we think is that doxis is a ligand that activates fat. And that's what it does, and that's always what it does. And when doxis activates fat, that pushes dox off the membrane. And when dox is off the membrane, the warts protein, we think, can accumulate and be active and phosphorylate Yorkie and keep it in the cytoplasm. Now, what we observe is that when there are differences in doxis expression, cells become polarized, and they become polarized such that dox accumulates on the cell, and it accumulates on the side of the cell farthest away from where you have highest amounts of doxis. So we know that when dox is on the membrane, that is functionally a situation that we see when the fat receptor is inactive. So we think that this is a situation that's equivalent to loss of fat activity. And when that dox protein is there on the membrane, we think it interacts with the Zix protein, and together they stimulate the degradation of this warts protein. And if warts isn't there, it can't phosphorylate Yorkie, And then YORCY, we think, can go into the nucleus and regulate gene expression. So there's a hypothesis or a speculation in this model, which is that the signal transduction pathway can be regulated differently on one side of a cell than it can on the other side of the cell. And the essence of our model is to propose that this transcriptional signal that we see, where we're clearly seeing YORCY activity stimulated by this ligand to activate fats, comes about not directly because of DOXIS binding to fat and activating this fat receptor, but because in some way it can polarize the cells. And when it polarizes the cells, the side of the cell opposite to where you have highest levels of DOX basically acts like it's not seeing any DOXIS signal at all. And it's giving you this transcriptional response. Yes? Yeah. Right. So that's a very interesting question, and this is something that we're still trying to look at. You know, how strong is the polarization? Is it an all or none response where you completely polarize, or are there intermediate levels where you can be partially polarized? And it's not always completely polarized. But we really don't have good quantitative data right now. This is something that we're trying to pursue further, is to get better quantitation of how strongly polarized it is. And there's also a caveat to everything that we've done up till now, which is that we were always overexpressing this tagged protein, and so that might also skew things a bit. We don't have good reporters for the endogenous protein. We have a bit of a difficulty in that to see the polarization, we have to express it in a patchy way, right? We have to have cells that express the tag protein and cells that don't. So we have to kind of overexpress it in that level. But we think we're getting better at being able to have the potential to quantify it by changing expression levels. And now we have fluorescent protein reporters, so at least we get rid of the antibody amplification steps. Yes?
So it seems like this story in some sensitive to
Wort's expression levels. Well, the whole pathway is definitely sensitive to Wort's levels or YORCY levels. I mean, if we overexpress Wort's, we can bypass, or not completely bypass, but we can suppress a lot of the effect of even a fat null mutant on growth. So it definitely is sensitive to Wort's levels. But it's not something we've tried to quantify again.
But I mean, is the expectation here
that you only have half the Wort's expression because we only have one side of the cell? Yeah, so, you know, we think the key thing in the end is how much YORCY gets in the nucleus, all right? And that you... Yes, compared to a fat null mutant, that would presumably be half, you might be able to get up to half the level of Wort's degradation. Yes? I'm sorry, no, I'm not quite following you yet. Why am I comparing? Right. Well, that's what we think, is one side is active and one side isn't. Yes. Well, the observation is that there is polarization, which we can see at the level of DOX, right? Well, what we're trying to explain is the difference between having growth at a boundary. What's different between having a boundary versus having a uniform expression when you have this DOXIS ligand? And so the essential thing, we think, is that when you polarize the cells, that the cells can behave as though, in a sense, they're not seeing DOXIS, so they're seeing less DOXIS than they really are.
Maybe I misunderstood.
It's not a single cell at the boundary, but it's concentrated around the boundary. And maybe I didn't emphasize this, it's actually on both sides of the boundary. So it's not only outside, it's also inside. Well, we think that, in a sense, I'm just the setup man for some of the modelers later. but we think that, part of what we think is that when the cells become polarized, that polarity might be able to propagate, for example, and influence neighboring cells. Yeah? Okay. All right, so let me, I'll try to get through one more thing, maybe. Well, one other thing that I wanted to say about this model is that we think it helps or provides a way for explaining another puzzling feature of this pathway, or it had something that had initially been puzzling, and that is that we have these two regulators of fat signaling, doxis and four-jointed. And they've been studied quite a bit in planar cell polarity, and in planar cell polarity studies, people would say that doxis and four-jointed have opposite effects on fat, right? Because they polarize cells or tissues in opposite directions. And I showed you actually one example of that, where they polarize the dox protein in opposite directions. So in some way they're affecting fat in opposite ways. But if we look at the transcriptional response to how does the transcriptional response of fat signaling respond to doxis and four-jointed, they seem to have identical effects on the pathway. And what I mean by that is that if we have a boundary of four-jointed expression, then we actually stimulate Yorkie activity. So we see that by increased type 1 expression, we could stimulate cell proliferation. Whereas if we express four-jointed uniformly, then we actually, seems like we activate fat and we decrease Yorkie activity. So we see that as decreased transcriptional activity and decreased growth. And I'm just showing you one example of that here. This is now just a different assay looking in an adult wing. If we uniformly express either doxis or four-jointed, we get a slightly smaller wing, and if we express them both together, we get an even smaller wing. So in the growth pathway, they're both working in the same direction, and in the polarity pathway, they're working in opposite directions. So we think this model thinking about how cells become polarized gives us a way to explain this, because basically we think the planar cell polarity response of the cell depends on the direction in which the cells are polarized, which we know is opposite. So dox goes to the membrane on one side of the cell or the other side of the cell, depending on whether you have high to low, four-jointed or high to low doxis. But the transcriptional response, we think, in the end just depends on how much Yorkie gets into the nucleus. And the cell doesn't care whether that Yorkie came from, in this case, the right side of the cell or the left side of the cell. It just cares how much Yorkie gets in. So this model also gives us a way to explain this puzzling observation that we have these regulators that for one response to the pathway, they're opposite, and for the other response, they work in the same direction. Yes? Can it be seen in the centrosome? In terms of how the cells become polarized, there is an effect on the orientation of cell division. We haven't really seen it at the level of the centrosome. Yes? Right. So that's an interesting question. If you had less Wurtz activity in one side of the cell, what happens when it divides and you have to reset it? So, yeah, so we don't know. I don't know. We have not seen any feedback, but we really haven't directly looked at that because we don't have a good antibody against doc. So there is feedback on a number of components of the Hippo pathway. So for example, four-jointed is a feedback target and some other components of the pathway, but docs, I don't know. We have no evidence that docs is phosphorylated in response to signaling by this pathway. But I couldn't exclude it either. We don't really know at a molecular level how the fat activity affects the docs myosin, how it affects its activity or localization. Yes?
Yeah, there's something that does not quite make sense to me at the moment, and I don't mean to be provocative, but when you say low dark cells, high dark cells, it seems that the two sites don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But you see polarity regardless of where you are, I mean, not completely regardless, but at different positions along the gradients. And as a matter of fact, when you're low dark cell site, the cell that is there, that is on this side,
yes,
is also polarized. That means
yes.
This is a high dose.
Yeah, I just mean this in a relative sense.
Yes.
Yes. So relatively higher, relatively lower.
My question is about
yes.
The relative sense. So does that depend also on cis dose cells? In other words, on this side, you have the cell as
well. Yeah, yes, right. Sure, like the cell over here.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, the best answer is I don't know, but we think that probably the answer is going to be yes, and that is a factor in this model that Madhav has. And basically, you know, the way we have thought about it is that in the normal developmental case, docs is pretty strongly polarized, but the gradients are pretty shallow. And so the idea that that you're influenced by the polarity of your neighbors effectively gives you a way to measure gradient over a bigger distance, you know, because you're coupling the polarity across this tissue. So we think that's probably the case. The two gradients.
The four-jointed gradient.
Yes.
And
doxis gradient. Yes.
To have one cell, you know, regardless of its position, be the signal sender in one end.
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of work in the planar cell polarity field about these gradients, and the idea is that they're normally both graded, but there's the information in these gradients that at some level is redundant, because as long as one of them is graded, things work pretty well. Okay, yes. Does Yorkie diffuse easily within the cell? I don't have any information about that. Yes. Right. Right. So then this wouldn't, the model basically requires that you can have signaling different on one side of the cell from the other, which implies that they're not all freely diffusing through the cell. But we have not measured diffusion. Yeah, so there's some fluorescent protein fusions, but we haven't tried to measure diffusion rates. Yeah.
Do these gradients in any way affect the position of the planes?
Along the proximal distal axis, where the cross veins are, is affected by this pathway, actually. So that's basically a diagnostic feature of the fat pathway, is that it affects the relative spacing of the cross veins. Yes?
I'm still trying to figure out, so you showed us a nice experiment at the beginning where you had activated kick vein and the film, and you got the non cell on the scope.
Yes? Yeah, so we've actually done that. We've looked, and so yes, that is the case. If you have activated thick vein clones, then you see increased Yorkie activity in those neighboring cells where you see increased proliferation. It's due to this pathway, and so in fact, I do have a kind of I have a few extra things in anticipating questions, so thank you for asking one of those. So the key experiment is, so here's the activated, another example of an activated thick veins clone, increased proliferation around the edge of the clone. And the one of the key experiments we did that tied, you know, the DPP pathway story to the FAT pathway story is, I told you that all of the growth transcription effects of the FAT pathway depend on DOX. So we do the same experiment, we make the activated thick vein clone, but now we do it in a DOX mutant. And we lose this non-autonomous effect. Okay, and again, that's something we've actually quantified. So the DPP pathway still can affect proliferation in an autonomous way, but this non-autonomous effect goes away. So it genetically, it depends upon the FAT pathway. So they are linked together in that way. That was your question. Should I stop? Well, I could say one thing about four-jointed, or I could be done. Say the thing about four-jointed. It's in a very highly schematic. No data, I promise. So the way that four-jointed affects the interactions between FAT and DOXIS. I wanted to tell you about it because I think it reinforces this idea that the important thing that these gradients are trying to do is to polarize cells. Right? So what we observed, and this was a collaboration with Mike Simon's group, is that when four-jointed is expressed on the FAT side, all right, in the FAT-expressing cell, it increases the binding between FAT and DOXIS, makes them bind better. Okay? So we did binding experiments in cultured cells. But when four-jointed is expressed on the DOXIS side, it makes the binding worse, makes them bind less well. So in a kind of conventional signaling pathway, it doesn't really make much sense to have a modulator that has a positive effect on the receptor and a negative effect on the ligand, because you'd be working at cross purposes then. But in terms of the way we think this pathway works, where you're interpreting gradients to polarize cells, we think it actually makes perfect sense. And I have this schematic, which people have already told me they found it confusing, but I'll try to go through it. So what I've tried to schematize here is three cells in a gradient of four-jointed, okay? And if we consider this cell right here, the four-jointed in this cell is having a positive effect on the FAT receptor and a negative effect on the DOXIS ligand, all right? And if we consider a cell at a lower position in this four-jointed gradient, four-jointed is doing the same thing, but because there's less four-jointed, it's having less of a positive effect on FAT and less of a negative effect on DOXIS. So basically what we expect is that if we compare two cells at different positions in this four-jointed gradient, the cell with more four-jointed has a relatively better FAT receptor and a relatively worse DOXIS ligand. And the cell with less four-jointed has a relatively better DOXIS ligand and a relatively worse FAT receptor, so that it's going to polarize the signaling between these cells, so that it's preferentially going from the cell with less four-jointed to the cell with more four-jointed. And then the same thing is going to occur at different points along the gradient. So in effect, we kind of uncouple things from the absolute levels of four-jointed, because if it's helping the receptor FAT be a better receptor to the same extent that it's helping DOXIS be a worse ligand, we're really just polarizing the signaling between them. And so because of this, we think that basically for every cell within this gradient, it's going to have a consequence of this four-jointed gradient is that you're going to have a higher level of FAT activity on one side of the cell next to the cells, neighboring cells with lower four-jointed, and lower FAT activity on the side of the cell with where you're next to cells with higher four-jointed. So basically, the way it works is helping to polarize cells in response to a gradient.
And isn't this effect even amplified by the DOX cells gradient? Isn't DOX cells higher?
Yeah, so DOXIS is, the DOXIS gradient is complementary, yes. So the DOXIS gradient would be going like this. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, Boris. Well, so to some extent, we've expressed it uniformly, yeah. Uh, Yeah, we actually haven't looked at that, I don't think. Yeah. But four-jointed genetically is still important, so I think it's still graded.
I don't know, but yeah.
But we have not actually tried to measure the four-jointed gradient. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, don't you think that the mother implies that where Perseus is engaged in trance might have a repressive effect on cis on fat?
Yeah, so we certainly, it would make sense to think that, you know, when doxis activates fat, that might, for example, affect the ability of doxis in that cell to work as a ligand. And that's actually incorporated in Madhav's model. So, yes, that makes sense. And, yeah.
When it's on the same side.
Yeah.
Because you still have polarized localization of dox.
Yes.
I might have
lost you. Yeah.
So in
terms of, you know, molecular and biochemical experiments, we don't know about interactions between fat and doxis in cis. So we don't know if they interact in cis or what role that might be. We don't have any experiments that directly address that. But it's certainly something that you could incorporate into models of the pathway. Okay, I'll stop now. Thank you.